The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
A special edition of Politics Weekly with me, Jeevan Vassagar, The Guardian's education editor. Last week, The Guardian hosted an open weekend of events, talks and concerts for readers and listeners. As part of that, I chaired a debate here in our London headquarters on the subject of schools and who should run them. It's been a particularly hot topic in England since the formation of the coalition government 2 years ago. Michael Gove, the education secretary, has wrestled control of schools away from local authorities and encouraged groups of parents and teachers to take over, often religious groups too. His mission, to see an improvement in schools that mirrors their increased independence.
I know that some have expressed concern that this offer of greater autonomy for schools will work against the collaborative model of school improvement that has grown up over the past 15 or so years, and which has done so much to tackle underperformance in those schools in the most challenging circumstances. Again, let me be clear. I would not be going down this road if I thought that it would in any way set back the process of school improvement already underway. If it would in any way undermine the progress that we need to make in our weakest or most challenged schools, or if it would in any way fracture the culture of collaboration which has driven school improvement over the last decade.
So, with this in mind, I threw the question of who should run our schools over to our panel. My colleague here at The Guardian, Jessica Shepherd, educationalist and Labour peer Andrew Adonis, who was an education minister in the last government, and, first up, columnist and school governor Fiona Miller. She wanted to clear up some common misconceptions.
I wanted to bust the myth, which is that we're here to talk about, you know, who should run our schools, and I wanted to bust the myth that local authorities run schools, because it's willfully misused by politicians all the time, that idea, and it's simply not true. Schools haven't been run by local authorities for over 20 years. Most schools are run by heads and governing bodies. And there are many types of maintained school within the school system that are not local authority schools. So I think that's the first thing I wanted to say. The second thing is, of course, it does matter who runs our schools. And we must have people who know how to do it effectively, with high expectations and a willingness to innovate and excite pupils. And by that is not the exclusive preserve, incidentally, of academies and free schools. In spite of what you read, there are many maintained schools that are doing a fantastic job. And the government's new performance tables makes that perfectly clear. I would also argue that schools need to have other values like inclusion, like a belief in education being a public good rather than a private good, and certainly not for private profit. And certainly, I think, an interest in the school's relationship with its local community. The third point I want to make is that it doesn't only matter who runs our schools, but it matters how we choose who runs our schools. It should be a bottom-up decision taken by and with the whole community, not by single interest groups who shout the loudest, and certainly not by a Secretary of State in Whitehall either blackmailing people, sacking governors and forcing change on unwilling communities, which is what we're seeing happening now, or by parachuting schools into communities against the wishes of the majority. And there are quite a few examples of that. I don't know if anybody's been following the situation in Suffolk, where a new free school is being proposed on the site of an existing academy, and the head is and there are already surplus places, and the head is fighting a very, very powerful campaign supported by the local community for that not to happen. And my prediction is that this rather rancorous and divisive way of running the system will ultimately fail, because I think if you want people to perform well, you need to encourage and support them rather than punish and blame them all the time and force them to do things they don't want to do. Finally, I want to say that I think it matters how we run our schools and who holds them to account. And we must have a level playing field, especially in issues like funding, admissions and exclusions. And that's not the case at the moment. The new changes to the admissions code are the thin end of a very thick wedge, in my point of view, where some schools will be given the power to opt out of the admissions code and have more control over who they take in. We can't see the funding of academies and free schools. That information simply isn't available. So we don't know if they get more money than maintained schools. And that seems to me wrong, especially for a government that talks about transparency. We've got a ludicrous situation where the government is creating a new national curriculum which won't apply to half the secondary schools in the country because they're not obliged to follow it. So I think it's wrong to give freedoms to some schools that others don't have. If a freedom is worth having, everybody should have it. And there are some freedoms that nobody should have. And finally, who holds them to account? I'm absolutely sure that in the next 10 years, we will have to recreate something that approximates the local authority, because every school can't be run from Whitehall. Schools will get into difficulties and somebody will have to step in to help resolve that situation at a local level.
For Andrew Adonis, the issue of who runs our schools was simple.
Who should run our schools is good professional people who are good at running schools. I mean, that stands to reason. We need people who are properly trained, the best head teachers and all of that. The more specific issue, which I think is one that causes division, is who should govern our schools. It's not who should run them. We all want the best professional people, the best teachers, the best head teachers to run them. It's who should govern the schools. And my view on who should govern the schools is it should be regulated by three things. Those who have the greatest capacity to produce very good results, because we need a step change in the performance of our school system. Those who've got the right values, and those who are properly accountable. And if I just say a word about those in turn. In terms of capacity, there is still, I'm afraid, and I spent the last 10 years saying this, there is still a deep complacency at stake in the way we view our education system. It's improving. It's actually improved a lot over the last 10 years. It's still a category below the best education systems in the world. Finland, South Korea, Singapore, I could go on, the best ones. In terms of the results they achieve, the average results they achieve, they're about a category higher than here in England. 93% of students graduate in Finland. That is reach an equivalent of well beyond our 5 GCSE, including English and Maths standard. In Singapore, where they still sit, English O-levels, they're still sat and marked by the Cambridge Exam Board. 82% last year got 5 good O-levels, including English and Maths. The equivalent figure in England is 59%. If we're going to be a successful country in the future, we're going to overcome class divisions and we're going to become more equal. We need a massive category change in the performance of our schools. So we need the best people governing the schools. We need the people who are best at running academies, those who are best at running local authority schools. We need successful schools, whatever the nature of those schools, whether they're independent, private, church, whatever it is. We need them all engaged in the process of creating more excellence in education. In terms of the values, we need people who run schools who are absolutely committed to inclusive education, who are committed to bridging educational divides, and who are passionate about tackling social disadvantage. Now, for my time as a minister, by far the trickiest issue when it comes to values is the issue of religious and faith-based schools. And I have to tell you, there is no answer to this. In a free society, we've got very strong faith communities. To deny those faith communities the right to have an expression of their faith in the education system simply encourages mass movement into the private sector, which is what has happened in other countries. I accept that that's a difficult issue. My own view is that what the state has to do is to see that these schools pay proper regard to social cohesion. The last government required Ofsted to inspect all schools, including faith schools, against social cohesion criteria. Unaccountably, the present government has removed that, and I think that should be reinstated. Thirdly, accountability. Schools, there's an argument about precisely how school governing bodies should be composed, but schools are more accountable than they've ever been in history. They're inspected now on a regular cycle. All the inspection reports are published. They're performance data is published. There's always more that can be published. I'm sure there's more financial other data and all that that can be published. But they are thoroughly accountable, and parents make choices as to where to send their children on the basis of all this data. My own view is that provided the data is properly prepared, it fairly compares like with like, it's better to publish it than not to publish it. I don't think anybody now would want to go back to the world where Ofsted reports weren't published, where exam grades and performance by school weren't published. I'm afraid it comes back, though it does put pressure on teachers and head teachers. It's, as Churchill said of democracy, it's the worst system going except the alternative. Keeping it all secret, I think, is worse than publishing it. So we want schools that are, in terms of their governance, that are accountable, that have the right values, that have real strength of leadership. But we need to be under no illusion that the big task which faces us as a country is to get another step change in the quality of education, the numbers who are succeeding, and bridging this appalling divide between the top and the bottom in our system, which historically is the bane of the English education system.
Our education correspondent Jessica Shepherd was next up. For her, the most controversial groups running schools can be broken down into three categories.
The charities that run academies, the for-profit companies that are given contracts to manage services for schools, and the parent groups who are setting up new schools. And I just want to say a little bit about all three of them. All academies and academy chains are run by charitable trusts that are not-for-profit, and these charitable trusts have to publish their accounts, and they are now subject to the Freedom of Information Act. But the problem of their lack of accountability, to my mind, remains. It's a remote Secretary of State who ultimately has oversight of these academies. All academies enter into a contract, and that's known as a funding agreement, with the Secretary of State and the charitable trust, and that provides the framework within which the academy must operate. These funding agreements are almost wholly undiscussed publicly. And there's very little parental and virtually no local authority involvement in the running of academies. Academy governors tend to be chosen rather than come forward from their local community. And some will see that as a good thing. The governors are chosen for their professional expertise, but they may not represent their communities. And let's not forget the powers that governors have. They can effectively sack head teachers if they see fit. On the other hand, the charitable trusts that run academies appear to be doing a good job in many cases. Many are running academies in the way that the best local authorities have done, although they probably hate to hear that. Some of the academy head teachers I talk to tell me they're given subject advisors in PE, maths and English. And that's a service, in some cases, local authorities can no longer afford. And what about for-profit companies? Well, the situation at the moment is that a school cannot be run for profit. Since 2002, charitable trusts have been allowed to let out contracts to a for-profit company to run a service. And recently, we've seen a bit of growth in the number of for-profits with contracts in schools. Earlier this month, Michael Gove gave the green light to Breckland Middle School, it's a really interesting case in Suffolk, to be renamed IES Breckland. IES is a Swedish for-profit firm, and the charitable trust that runs Breckland has basically contracted out management of the school. It's a contract for 10 years and it's worth 21 million. For some, that's unpalatable, but it's actually not the same as a for-profit company directly gaining profit from each pupil. And schools have not been wholly run by the public sector for decades, but there does seem to be an increase in the number of for-profits with an involvement in schools. Gove has said that we don't need profit-making organisations at the moment. And my reading is that Gove is not ideologically against for-profits running schools, but that there are too many changes in the secondary school system at the moment to make this an immediate priority. Politically, it seems the Conservatives have made a calculation that the time is not right to have a debate on the privatisation of schools.
Andrew Adonis put his opposition to for-profit schools on the record.
I don't support for-profit schools. I haven't seen any evidence. I mean, I've looked carefully because a number of the for-profit organisations when I was minister wanted to come and set up here. We had Edison and Kunskapsskolan who wanted to set up. So I looked carefully at their schools. It wasn't clear to me that they performed better than not-for-profit schools in their system. Though, if you're going to do something as controversial, and I've been at the leading edge of doing controversial things, I'm perfectly prepared to do controversial things, but I think it's going to lead to a very big public benefit. I see no big public benefit that comes from having for-profit schools. The bit of the private sector that you need to get much more engaged in English education isn't the for-profit sector, which is very small in this country. It's actually quite small internationally. It's the not-for-profit sector. We have a hugely powerful not-for-profit education sector in this country. We have all of the universities and higher education, all not-for-profit institutions. We have all of our private schools, which most people don't realise, are not-for-profit institutions. They're charities in a slightly perverse way that we define charities in this country, but they are. They have charitable assets which are there to be devoted to the public good. We have very large numbers of educational trusts and foundations for historic reasons. This is the way that charities are developed. A lot of them are educational foundations. The big task, which I set about when I was in government and is a good part of the justification for the Academies programme, is to get this huge public resource that we've got in terms of charitable endeavour, in terms of not-for-profit organisations, in terms of universities, to be engaged, not only in state education at large, but particularly in state education geared to the most disadvantaged communities. That is the big challenge which faces us. If we can pull that off, we will have unleashed huge amounts of creative energy in this country. We shouldn't go near for-profit schools, which to my mind are a complete distraction from the task facing us.
But Fiona Miller was keen to pick him up on the thorny problem of admissions.
I'm glad Andrew talked about faith schools. I've got no objection to faith groups running schools. I don't think they should be allowed to select their pupils according to their parents' faith. And that's ripe for exploitation. I'm glad he talked about inclusion. I hope that means he's come round to the point of view that we should get rid of the 11 plus and have really inclusive schools, not some schools that reject children at 11 on the basis of academic ability. But these are, you know, while you've got these hierarchies, you're never going to solve the fundamental problem. So that, I mean, I think we need a big look at how we create more balanced schools in every community. On the issue of, I mean, you're absolutely right. Look at this year's performance tables. The accountability is great. We've been through, at the Local Schools Network, we've been through all the results of all the academies and the maintained schools. There is no difference in the outcomes. In fact, the maintained schools are just, in every single group, progress, disadvantaged children, numbers of free school meals, maintained schools are actually outperforming the sponsored academies. So over time, it doesn't really matter whether you're an academy or a maintained school or a faith school or whatever. What matters is the leadership and the quality of teaching. And so that's the second thing I would say we should get back to, is focusing on what goes on within the schools rather than try and restructure the very wasteful and expensive project of restructuring the governance of all the schools and just concentrate on making every school as good as it could be by supporting it, not by blaming it and sending, you know, the witchfinder general in to tell them they're all useless. Because I don't think it'll work. You'll drive people out of the profession and that will be very, very negative for the children.
Many of the examples Michael Gove has used in recent speeches have come from Scandinavia. But one member of the audience, familiar with the Swedish system, sounded a note of caution.
The whole idea from the beginning in Sweden was that it would be parent groups who started schools, be they Toby Young or whoever. But what ended up was that after a few years, these parents' groups generally sold them to IES, Kunskapsskolan, and all these companies. These are basically companies backed by venture capital, so they're not actually taxed in Sweden either. There is a very little nifty way of getting out of tax.
Jessica Shepherd agreed.
You make a really good point about, we're always saying about the fantastic results of Sweden. And one thing that is not often said is that actually this fragmentation has led to increased social segregation, which sort of brings on to your point as well. And as two other speakers have said, that historically our education system has always sort of favoured the pushy middle classes. I'm not sure what we can do about pushy middle classes buying houses in near to top performing schools and making it so that the house prices are prevent others from living in that area.
For Andrew Adonis, the latest upheaval is just that, the latest in a long line of tinkering with a school system that is full of variety already.
If you look at the history of English education, it has been rigidly segregated and stratified. The idea there was this golden age when somehow the system was quote-unquote unified and it's now being divided, as we all know, complete nonsense. In the book I'm writing on education at the moment, which has a lot to say about these issues, I go back to the whole history of the secondary moderns. I mean, it's impossible to overestimate the scale of the educational disaster brought about by the secondary modern school in the 1950s and 60s, and we haven't properly recovered from it now. What's the job of the state? And I use the word state deliberately because, you know, the state is the voice of the national community. It is to do everything it possibly can to redress this history of chronic disadvantage, which is why the last government, when we were engaged in bold investment and innovation in this area, we concentrated the investment and innovation at the bottom, which were the schools, which were the communities where the academies were being created, which were the schools being converted into academies and being given very substantial investment. They were in the most deprived communities with the most challenging intakes with the lowest educational standards. Now, what's my criticism of the current government is that they haven't maintained that focus. They should have maintained that focus.
It was at this point that some in the audience turned on us, or at least chided us journalists for the way the media, and some newspapers in particular, report education stories. Fiona Miller, for one, was sympathetic.
The current climate is incredibly negative about what goes on in schools, negative about teachers, negative about parents, negative about schools. It's very corrosive. I do, and I'm not saying this applies to The Guardian, incidentally, of course, but and I would recommend everybody here get the book by Ben Levin, How to Change 5,000 Schools, about what happened in Ontario in Canada, where they had a situation with a quite far-right government that insisted on doing all the things that Michael Gove's now, and in particular, running down the profession. They had a new government came in, they knew they had to arrest the situation, and they just looked at what worked and focused on implementing it, and then they focused on talking up the system to give parents confidence. Because one of the problems we've got now is that we're creating this generation of unbelievably anxious parents. I mean, my children, but the youngest one is about to leave school this summer, but I've had 20 years as a parent and governor in London, and it's been a very interesting experience. And I've never seen anything like the levels of anxiety now. That, you know, if your child doesn't get into the right school, they are going to fail. Well, no, they probably won't fail if they're a certain type of child. If both their parents went to Oxford and Cambridge and they've got a very good home learning environment, the chances are in a good enough school, they will be fine. But the feeling of fear, so there's fear in the schools about the way they're going to be judged, there's fear amongst parents about what's going to happen to their children and that they're going to be judged by their children's performance in a way. And I just think we need to take the heat out of this situation. I'm not condoning poor performance at all, and as a governor I've had to address some very difficult issues over the past few years, but the way to get people to perform well is to support them, invest in them and make them feel good about what they're doing. If they're performing badly, by all means address that, but it is not by telling them they're all rubbish. And I'm sure Andrew's intentions are good about getting people into the teaching profession, but why would anybody become a teacher now, and why would anybody become a head? I mean, I don't know why people would do it.
Jessica Shepherd admitted that the media could do better in broadening its horizons and getting out of London more often.
One thing I certainly find is that there's a very small pool of schools whose praises are sung time and time again. We've all heard of Mossbourne. I mean, there are many Mossbournes. Why do we keep having to, you know, to hear about this one? And likewise, there's a school that became an academy last year in Merseyside that is now in special measures. We're not hearing about that. So it's actually very selective. Mm. It's not necessarily always negative, but there's a very clear agenda.
To end the session, we threw it back to Lord Adonis, the only one in the room who has been in a position to actually alter schools policy as a minister.
What is my regrets? My regrets, I'll be quite frank with you, is that we didn't move fast enough on academies. We should have done far more, and we should have done it much sooner. Because academies, and of course they're not all excellent, you know, I mean, like all big social reforms, some bits of it work better than others. But the thing about academies is they go to the root of this issue of governance. The difference that an academy makes fundamentally is the difference between having poor governance and good governance. That the organisations that you put in charge of the academies, the individuals who take charge of them, have a track record of success in terms of managing institutions. They're focused resolutely on getting high results. They have the right values. They have the right accountability. And the evidence speaks for itself. I mean, Fiona and I obviously disagree about this, but there have been three big independent studies of academies. All three of those have found very significant improvements in results vis-a-vis schools with a similar intake that aren't academies. It is absolutely true. It's absolutely true if you look at it. Well, Fiona and I will disagree on this, but there have been three independent studies. All three of them have shown a big difference. All the ones that don't are the ones which use selective statistics, usually by people who want to prove a point which they've decided at the outset. Now, on this issue then finally about teaching and teachers, we cannot be fatalistic about this. We have got a big problem as a society, and this goes back really to the development of state education, that teaching has been seen as a low status profession, unlike countries like a lot of Eastern Europe and Scandinavia and the Far East, where teaching is a prestigious profession. It's not in fact true to say that teaching is universally not a prestigious profession in this country. Our top private schools have no difficulty recruiting the brightest and the best. Typically, a public school in this country will have a third of its teachers will be Oxbridge, another third Russell Group universities. I mean, they have no difficulty recruiting them. Our problem has been recruiting and having high prestige for teaching as a national endeavour across all types of schools. Now, as I look back over the last 10 years, some things have started to make a difference. I mean, unsurprisingly, paying teachers more makes a difference, particularly if you pay them more as starting salaries. We still expect our teachers in this country to train at their own expense. None of these other professions, which are at your careers fair, expect them to do that. They all pay them from the outset. Or if they're lawyers, of course, they know they're going to reap huge rewards thereafter. So we need a big change in the way that we reward teachers and train them. Also, teach first has made a huge difference. If you take that, the top most selective universities, Teach First has transformed the numbers who are coming into teaching. And the thing about Teach First is they all go into the third most challenging comprehensives, whereas traditionally, even those who go from the most selective universities into teaching all end up at the top end state schools or in private schools. We've got a lot to learn from that. My own view is that we can't expand Teach First fast enough. We need to do a real hearts and minds job on the top universities and their graduates. This is a really big and important thing that they can do both for themselves and for their country. And we shouldn't be afraid of talking about values, duty, mission, all those things that make a good society work, and all of which depend crucially on the quality of our schools and the quality of our teaching profession.
Politicians may have been culpable for education cock-ups past and present. But should politicians simply exit stage left and leave the floor to experts? Not so fast.
The idea this should somehow be taken out of the realm of democratic political debate and given to quote-unquote experts, all of whom, of course, will have their own views. You know, I mean, take the issue of the 11+, they'll have their own views on that. You know, are these decisions somehow going to be taken completely apart from the democratic political process? What you actually want is an informed debate amongst opinion formers. And you also want, and this is something which I think has changed for the better in the last 20 years, you want your politicians to regard education as a central national priority. When Tony Blair said that his three priorities were famously education, 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 and John Major said in response he had the same three priorities but not necessarily in the same order, that, I think, was a breakthrough moment for us as a country. You know, remember when Jim Callaghan made his Ruskin College speech in whenever it was, 1976? That was the first time that a Prime Minister had made a speech in living memory on state education. He started the speech by apologising for making it because he said that he'd been given plenty of advice that prime ministers weren't supposed to make speeches. Tony Blair is the first prime minister in the history of this country, including Labour prime ministers, who sent his child to a state secondary school. You know, until one of the things, by the way, which was very clear to me, the first time ever, you know, we've only had, well, of course, David Cameron hasn't got children who are secondary school age yet, but it hasn't happened. But in my experience, now, I find this very striking as a minister, the politicians who most cared about state education were those who used it. This is a fundamental principle in society. If they themselves, indeed, there was one classic case where I had an absolutely terrible situation to deal with of a school that was in a very serious state. And I had the MP on the phone to me every single day about it. Why? Because her children went to the school. And the moral I drew from that is that if all our politicians actually sent their children to state schools, whereas unfortunately too many, particularly if I can make a party point, on the Conservative side don't, then of course they don't care about it. Caring about things fundamentally depends upon whether you use these services yourself, and that's what's needed. But I don't think you can make this a non-political activity.
Isn't the logic about you closing private schools?
Well, it's a free society. There's no way you can close the private schools. I mean, you'd be, it's just not a possible thing to do in a free society. So, alas, you know, it's important to talk about things you can do and things you can't. Yeah, well, I'm very keen on seeing that they do more as charities. I spend all my time telling them that they should sponsor academies, that they should take their charitable duty seriously. But what you can't do, I think, is abolish them.
On that note of discord, we should stop. Thank you all very much for coming. And on that note of controversy, our time is up. My thanks go to Jessica Shepherd, Andrew Adonis, Fiona Miller, and everyone who attended the session here at The Guardian. You can leave your thoughts on the podcast page at guardian.co.uk/politics. Tom Clark will be back after Easter, when normal Politics Weekly service resumes. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Jeevan Vasagar. Thanks for listening.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details. For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.